Good evening. Welcome to the Soleri Report. Today is Thursday, September 16th, 2010. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, Money and Markets, and Ask Catherine, then an interview with Dr. Robert Lustig on sugar addiction, getting it and ending it. For our documentary this evening, I posted Dr. Lustig's presentation last year called Sugar, the Bitter Truth. Outstanding. I just watched it for, I think, the fourth time, and I learn something every time I watch it. Our theme tonight is pushback time, and part of that relates to the fact that we're seeing all across the country and the world, this is a global phenomena, real frustration about what's happening. And a lot of it is, again, the model of governance and the management of the economy is converting, and more people feel frustrated as the old model breaks down and doesn't work, and yet the new one is still sort of burping out and emerging. So pushback time is here. Money and markets. The media this week did not have its most noble week. I sat down and I thought, what's the most offensive thing that happened? It's hard to choose. There is much greater focus in Europe and the United States on long-term structural unemployment, and yet when you listen to the coverage, there's no mention of the fact that this policy is the result of intentional actions. We knew in the mid-90s when we passed the Uruguay round of GATT and adopted NAFTA that this would happen again. If you haven't watched the Sir James Goldsmith video, please do go to my blog. Just do a search for Sir James Goldsmith, and you'll get his wonderful interview in 1994 with Charlie Rose. We saw an unbelievably creative description by Larry Summers, the National Economic Advisor, explaining how the recovery continues without employment. Again, sort of, how corporations can improve their situation without people having jobs or income. So the sort of the greater structural unemployment and the its impact on income and poverty in the press, but no real description of how this happened and why this happened. Second thing is the silence in the Gulf oil spill is so eerie, you can almost hear the silence. The ecological and economic impacts continue to be chilling, and yet we really don't have the coverage we need to understand what's going on. The power of the blackout speaks volumes about the central control of the media. And finally, the shrillness of the distractions around 9/11 were very unpleasant, another reason to turn off your TV. The story this week in Washington is clearly the elections. The elections are coming. The Democrats knew they were in real trouble. The president has been out using all of his stature and the power of his office to try and address the concerns the country has about the economy. It's not working. If anything, it's boomeranging, and we're seeing real concern that if the Democrats don't do everything they can, in addition to losing the House, they could lose the Senate. You have more than a few Democrats just saying, this whole election is lost. And part of the issue for each congressional candidate is, will the election be about the specific candidate, or will it be a referendum on the administration and the state of the economy? If it's a referendum on the administration and in that, the state of the economy, it's going to be, I believe that we could see the Democrats even lose the Senate. So it's an extraordinary situation. And it has impacts on policy in the short run, not in the intermediate or long run, but certainly in the short run. And one of them is a very good sign, although it's only short-term relief, is the food safety bill has now been shelved. The speaker has said that there is not time to get it done given the concerns about the bill, and not time to do it before Congress has to leave to go on the campaign trail, given the egg recalls and really the profound dirtiness of the economic warfare and the dirty tricks around this, it's a very good sign that they couldn't get the food safety bill done. And it's another reason why I say pushback time is here. Financing the deficit. There is a very large post up on the blog about the Department of Labor and Treasury joint hearings at the Department of Labor earlier this week on the use of retirement savings to do a variety of things, but essentially they all come down to financing the deficit. Now, this is the coverage of the possible changes of rules on 401ks and IRAs are something we've been covering a long time. We get a lot of questions. It's something that I continue to be nervous about, and the reason is the same that, as Willie Horton said, the reason he robbed banks was because that's where the money is. If we're going to continue to finance the deficit, then the question is, where are we going to get the money? We can print it. We can run around the globe and try and persuade the Chinese, the Japanese, the Saudis to do more. The fact of the matter is there's $16.5 trillion in retirement savings. That includes $4.3 trillion as of the end of the first quarter, 2010 in IRAs, and about $4.2 trillion in employee-sponsored direct contribution plans, of which about $2.9 trillion is in 401ks. So 401ks and IRAs are about $7 trillion. If you go to the U.S. debt clock, and I know we've done this before on the Solari report, but you can't study it too much, what it will show is our current on-balance sheet debt is $43,000 per citizen. But if you count up contingent liabilities for Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, it's over $300,000 in contingent liabilities. And one of the reasons for the growing deficit is that $300,000 is now moving into the current accounts as the population ages. And at some point, as we go to the Chinese, the Japanese, and the Saudis and say, hey, you need to buy more treasuries, they're going to sit and say, well, listen, the reason you want to buy more, you know, you want to finance more, among other things, is you want to pay all your citizens Social Security. But they have $7 trillion sitting in their accounts. Why don't you use their money? If these payments are for them, why not get it from them? So the politics of the squeeze coming from the U.S. debt clock is profound, and that's why I really recommend you go take a look at it. It's usdebtclock.org. If you're sitting as the man in the street looking at what's going on in Washington and Wall Street, the idea that the administration would force our IRAs and 401ks to be invested in Treasury or to be channeled in a variety of ways that would ultimately really finance the deficit, it doesn't seem logical. It just seems, you know, as though something that if it happened, it could take a long time. At the same time, if you look at the debt clock, what you realize is this is coming, and it may be coming faster than we think. The hearings, interestingly enough, were not in Congress. They were over at the Department of Labor, and that's one of the things you do in the administration if you want to keep it lower down on the radar screen. It was run by a deputy assistant secretary from Treasury and assistant secretary of Labor. Again, if you look at the people involved, they're trying to keep it low down, sort of in the stature and the pecking order of Washington. Now, that's what you, if you're planning on jamming somebody politically, and this is a very large somebody, it's always important to keep it down with unimportant people, keep it at a low level. Because right now what they're trying to do is figure out the right logistics and the spin to market proposals. And here's what they want to accomplish, because you're seeing a series of proposals, but they all drop into one of two buckets. One is to put more money in the cup. So how can we make the $7 trillion go up to $9 trillion or more? And then how can we channel more of that $9 trillion to financing the deficit? So it's sort of put more in the cup, and how do you stick a straw in the cup? There are different proposals and different options. The ones I continue to watch and think are important are as follows. One is mandatory requirements that small business provides 401ks to make it more politically palatable. Employees have the option of opting out. Essentially what this is doing is, it's, if anything, it's a tax on small business, and it's basically saying small business cannot channel benefits to workers other than kind of through a mechanism that finances the government. You know, or I should say it says that informally. The other is the idea of when a person is ready to withdraw from an IRA or 401k, when the time comes that they're eligible to withdraw, instead of getting their money back, they get an annuity that is, in essence, a stream of income. The word annuity has been very not popular, and now the word has been converted to lifetime income. What this means, and this is a very chilling term, because what it means is, rather than get your 10,000, let's say you're ready to withdraw 10,000, you're 59 and a half, you decide to take 10,000 out, you don't get $10,000, you get an annuity valued at 10,000 that gives you a stream of income at whatever the interest rate would be set at. Now, at the end of the annuity, if you die, presumably the question is what happens? Does your spouse get the annuity? Does your children get the annuity? Or if it's just lifetime, does the income stop at death? Because what this means is the money's been confiscated. Now, we're watching in this, in the hearings, we're watching some pretty credible players start to promote this concept of lifetime income, endorsements from TIA, Kraft, Putnam. To me, lifetime income is a euphemism for confiscation. We've seen a transition in this country from a notion of Americans as people who have equity in businesses. They're owners of their small businesses. They own the means of production so we've seen a phase from people being owners to employees where instead they're financing other people's ownership of the means of production. And now what we're watching is a conversion. We've converted from equity to financial assets. Now we're watching a conversion where it's not asset, it's simply lifetime income. That means we're dependents waiting for the system to send us a check each month. So instead of withdrawing your money as a lump sum, you get, they're calling it lifetime income just because annuity is unpopular. Now, the way this could first be instituted is as a volunteer option. From a political standpoint, the easiest way to get this done is to figure out what the mousetrap looks like, institute it on a voluntary basis, get the kinks worked out, and then take it to mandatory. Obviously, there are all sorts of nuts and bolts to be worked out. There's lots of feedback to the government that people are not interested in this kind of arrangement, and we had some extraordinary quotes. Let me just read you a couple, because one of the people is my hero of the week, Betsy Kramer in Georgia. The Department of Labor got 779 public comments before the hero. Betsy Kramer in Georgia says, quote, "Are you crazy?" That was comment 492. Michael Mathis said, quote, "Keep your hands off my 401k. That was comment number 3. And Thomas Volk from Walla Walla, Washington, comment number 14, said, quote, "This is a recipe for civil unrest." So, again, you can hear the pushback time. And what we're hearing is sort of a negotiation between the powers that be and $7 trillion worth of retirement savings. How do you come up with a spin that makes this palatable? One of the things that's going to happen is there are going to be a group of politicians and think tanks who, if they figure out how to sell this, are going to get some very big bonuses and promotions. Two of the think tanks that are promoting part of these solutions are Brookings and Heritage. You know, it's pretty depressing to see all that intellectual capital going to work to do this. Here's the issue for all of us. If you are an investor who has an IRA or a 401k, the question is, what do you do if you have a small business or a business that has a 401k? You want to do the right thing by your employees. The question is, what do you do? My prediction is nothing's going to happen this year. Congress has to go out on the campaign. The feedback on the hearing and coming into the hearing with the public comments was extremely negative. I see a very small chance of anything happening this year. If you look at the U.S. debt clock, there is a fairly good chance that something will happen next year. So now is the time to start thinking about how you feel about the value of control. What is a dollar that you control versus a dollar you don't control that could convert into this kind of relation or sort of structure? And now is the time to start thinking about it. So it's not a 2010 issue, but I think it will be a 2011 issue, and if not 2011, 2012. Okay, very briefly, a roundup of markets. The stock market, the election's very important when it comes to the stock market. If we see a real stock market consolidation, it's going to be intolerable for the Democrats. So there is tremendous pressure on the Fed and Treasury to make sure that liquidity is available so that the market stays up despite very significant individual redemptions that appear to continue. Now, one thing to watch for is a correction post-November if they're successful in doing that. If they're not successful in doing that, November and the elections are going to get pretty wild. If you think a pushback is bad when everybody's IRAs are down 20% is even worse. Precious metals markets, we have some very funny spinning going back and forth. Greenspan telling the Council on Foreign Relations that money in fiat paper has no place to go but gold. He's advising the Paulson Fund, which has very significant positions. Meantime, we have Soros back out saying there's a bubble. Of course, he has very big positions in gold as well. And, you know, and essentially that gold could go to nothing. So a lot of spinning back and forth. Those articles are up on the blog. In the housing markets, foreclosures continue to rise. Again and again, we're told that workouts are available thanks to the administration, but if you talk to servicers or people dealing, particularly lawyers dealing with foreclosures all over the country, for an individual person with a troubled mortgage to try and get a workout is a nightmare. Trying to get the servicers to answer the telephone is a nightmare, let alone trying and process a workout through the system. So there's a real gap between what the administration is saying they've made available and what's really happening down at the grassroots. The municipal market, very interesting to watch the referendum coming up in California on medical marijuana. The states that have significant marijuana crops, there's a real push to get that some of that retail business pumping through the sales and other taxes. And so you're seeing a real economic pressure from the municipal market to do more legalization. But more importantly, places like California can no longer afford the private prisons. Extraordinary number of prison sentences coming off of drugs, including marijuana. And literally that economic model is not going to work anymore. In the bond market, everybody had fun last week. Franklin disagreed with me. I said I wouldn't put everything in precious metals. I like some fixed income. And what I discovered from the feedback is I should sit down and make a list of everything Franklin and I disagree on, because you all found it fun and interesting. But I got a great question as to where, what kind of fixed income I like. Let me run through that briefly. That's the most important question for Ask Catherine. I like some money in local bank and credit unions, in CDs. Interestingly enough, depending on where you are in the country, one way to do a little bit better in yield and do something that I think is grounded in real economics is a very well-managed community loan development fund. Check out and see if there's something like that in your area. It's very interesting. I had one client who during the 2008 crisis decided, that's it, I've given up putting money in a brokerage account, and went to Kiva.org to do microloans with investors, you know, in the emerging markets around the world, and found out that all the loans had been filled. There was no capacity. People were taking their money out of the brokerage system and putting it into into microloans to small entrepreneurs around the world. Sovereign bonds, you want to focus on credit that's based in fundamental economics, so they have low debt, strong natural resources, or a growing economy, but really a history of lawful practices. So there are sovereign bond credits that are very, very strong because the fundamental economics are strong and the fiscal management is prudent. Corporate bonds, over time we're going to see corporations look better financially than many governments. Obviously, the area of opportunity is in the areas of the world where there's growing equity. Given the uncertainties in monetary policy, short duration is what I like. Check out, if you go to your cart and go to the first date in the archive, what you'll find is that you'll have access to all of our audio seminars. There's an audio seminar called Positioning Your Assets for Growth in Uncertain Times, and that audio seminar comes with transcripts and lots of charts, and we'll go into much more. So I encourage you, if you're interested in sort of options in fixed income and how to use them, I would really encourage you to listen to that audio seminar. So now it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Robert Lustig. Dr. Lustig is a professor of clinical pediatrics in the Division of Endocrinology at the University of California, San Francisco. And I, like many people, discovered Dr. Robert Lustig through just a marvelous video of a presentation he made last year called Sugar, the Bitter Truth, and also through a wonderful subscriber to the Solari Report who had struggled with sugar addiction, and through learning of Dr. Lustig's work, healed himself, clued me into Dr. Lustig and how this worked, and has had a profound impact on my health. So I can't tell you what a pleasure it is, Dr. Lustig, to have you join us on the Solari Report.
Well, thank you so much, Ms. Fitz. I have to say that video my claim to fame.
Did you know when you gave that lecture that it would rocket, across the globe?
Not a clue. In fact, I didn't even know that lecture was going to be posted. I gave a lecture here at UC San Francisco. It's called Mini Med School for the Public. I didn't even realize it was being televised. I thought it was over, and then all of a sudden I find out 2 months later that UCTV, videotapes these things, posted it to YouTube, and I have to say the response has been more than overwhelming.
Well, tell us how you got involved and interested in the role of sugar and the challenges we have with our food supply. How did that happen?
I have to say completely through the back door. This was not something I started out being interested in, even remotely. I am a neuroendocrinologist, which means I'm interested in how the brain controls various hormone systems in the body and vice versa. Certainly obesity is a neuroendocrine disturbance. That is, that the brain is not responding to signals from the body and is driving food intake and changes in energy expenditure. So certainly obesity qualifies within my purview, but it wasn't something I started out being interested in. About over 15 years ago, I was an attending physician at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee, where I took care of a lot of kids with brain tumors. And these kids are famous for gaining weight like crazy, over a kilo a month. These kids gain weight basically. They look at food and they gain weight. One of our founding fathers of obesity research in this country, George Bray, took 8 of these kids many years ago, locked them up on his clinical research center, threw away the key, and fed them 500 calories a day for a month, and they gained weight. Now, how do you gain weight on 500 calories a day? The answer, if you're storing them instead of burning them, that's how. And so these kids had become the bane of my existence, and they were unbelievably sad. And I was charged with taking care of them. Well, did a little bit of research, did a little bit of reading on Dr. Bray's work, and it seemed like there was a connection between the brain and the pancreas. And the pancreas, as you know, is the organ that makes insulin, and insulin's job is to store energy. It is the energy storage hormone. And according to Dr. Bray, the hypothalamus, this area of the brain that controls energy balance, tells the pancreas what to do. And when the pancreas makes extra insulin, you would store it. So we hypothesized many, many years ago that if we blocked insulin release right at the pancreas with a medicine, Now, this medicine is not approved for this purpose, so it's, you know, not something that your, you know, readers and listeners should go out and, you know, try to ask their physician about. This was purely a tool to see how what the physiology of this was. But we went ahead and gave these kids this medicine called octreotide, which I know how to use. And all of a sudden, not only did these kids start losing weight, but they started exercising spontaneously, out of the blue. I got comments from parents like, this is the first time I've got my kid back since the brain tumor. The kids would say things like, this is the first time my head hasn't been in the clouds since the diagnosis of the tumor. This is really pretty remarkable. 4 of my 8 kids started exercising spontaneously. I started lifting weights at home. One kid became a competitive swimmer. One kid became the manager of his high school basketball team. These were kids who sat on the couch, ate Doritos, and slept. And now all of a sudden,
the subscriber who introduced me to your work said that's exactly what happened to him.
Well,
all of a sudden, he just loved to exercise.
Yeah, and it was really remarkable. So we did it again, and it happened again. So I said, you know, this is really interesting. Is it possible that there is a population of adult obese patients who would respond the same way, who have the same insulin problem and would respond the same way to the drug? So we did it again, this time in adults, and it happened again. And so we did it in a double-blind placebo-controlled trial, and it happened a fourth time. Now, one time, maybe something a little weird's going on. But if it happens 4 times, twice in children, twice in adults, both done with double-blind placebo-controlled, you can be pretty sure that this is going on. This is real. So that led me to the idea that the behaviors that we see, that is the gluttony and sloth, the increased intake and the decreased energy expenditure, were actually being driven by a biochemical process that was out of these people's control. And that by giving a medication that interfered with that process, you could actually reverse the process and bring things back to normal.
And
so that's how I got started.
How did you find the connection to fructose?
Okay, well, over the past decade, there's been a lot of work that's gone into the question of whether or not fructose, that is, the sweet part of the sugar molecule, you know, that sugar or sucrose, table sugar, beet sugar, cane sugar, is 2 molecules. It's glucose and fructose bound together. Glucose is not a problem. Fructose may be a problem. And a lot of work's been going on now because fructose is specifically metabolized by the liver. And because it's metabolized by the liver can be overloaded. It can basically get too much. And if it gets too much, then bad things can happen. And that had been shown in several animal studies, and it started being shown in some human studies. Since that time, there's been an enormous wealth of literature that's come out that basically corroborates that there's mechanistic data and there's epidemiologic data that says that increased fructose consumption overwhelms your liver's capacity to be able to metabolize it, and in the process starts doing bad things to your liver, creating a phenomenon called insulin resistance, that is, too much insulin. And my work said too much insulin makes you gluttony and slothy. So we put 2 and 2 together and said maybe the sugar glut, maybe the increase in sugar consumption that has gone on over the last 100 years, because we now consume 6 times the amount of sugar per day that we used to, say, 100 years ago. Our ancestors, getting sugar out of the ground from fruits and vegetables, would consume about 15 grams of fructose a day. We are now up to 100 in this country. We are consuming 22 teaspoons of sugar per day on average in this country. It's
many people don't realize how much sugar they're consuming because it's now in everything.
Well, that's the point. The point is you don't go out and look for the sugar. It's there to find you because
right.
It's in every single processed food. And it's there for a very specific reason. It's there because when they put it in, you buy more. They have found a way around their, you know, our ability to control our weight and therefore and control our appetite. Since the introduction of high fructose corn syrup in 1975, The annual profit margin, your viewers will, you know, certainly get a kick out of this. The annual profit margin of the food industry has gone from 1% per year, commensurate with the increase in the general population, to 5% per year.
So I had no idea.
Yeah. So in other words, before the advent of high fructose corn syrup, the increase in our food intake was basically because of the increase in our population. In other words, they were selling the same amount of food, but to more people. Now, in the last 30 years, they have quintupled that. And our total caloric intake has gone up to 3,900 calories per day when we can only eat 1,800. I'm sorry, I take it back. The amount of food that they produce is 3,900 a day when we can only eat 1,800. In other words, they produce double the food that our country needs per day. The question is, who's going to eat the rest? And the answer is, we do.
One of the things I found absolutely fascinating in Sugar the Bitter Truth is the role of fiber.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe if you could just touch on that.
Well, so there are two antidotes to fructose. There's two ways to make the liver do a better job with this onslaught of sugar. The first is fiber. Now, obviously, wherever there's fructose in nature, there's way more fiber. So, like, for instance, sugar cane is a perfect example. It's a stick. I mean, you can't even get the stuff out. You have to suck it out. So wherever there's fructose, there's fiber. And the reason the fiber is there is to delay the fructose absorption from the gut into the bloodstream. By doing so, it allows your liver a chance to metabolize what's coming in, so that you don't get the buildup of the toxic metabolites. So fiber is one of the antidotes to fructose. When you consume sugar as God intended it, that is, in fruits and vegetables, number one, the fiber is satiating, so you don't overdo it. For instance, when was the last time you saw a kid eat more than one orange? Doesn't happen.
Never seen a kid eat more than one orange.
Okay. On the other hand, when was the last time you saw a kid drink more than one glass of orange juice? How about today?
Actually, it was last month, but yes.
Well, you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Okay. So which would you rather have? An orange which has 15 calories worth of fructose and loads of fiber, or a glass of orange juice which has 60 calories of fructose and no fiber?
And no fiber.
Which do you think makes more sense? Very clear.
The orange, yeah.
Right. So fiber is one of the antidotes to fructose consumption. The second antidote is exercise. Now, people think exercise causes weight loss. Garbage. Absolutely not true. Not one study, there's not one study on record that shows that exercise changes weight. If anything, it actually increases weight. And the reason it increases weight is because it's increasing muscle. Now, muscle is good because muscle has a chance to burn off the stuff, whereas fat doesn't. But even more to the point, what happens when you exercise is that your liver's enzymes that normally burn off glucose and fructose, for that matter, they increase in their speed. And so you never get to the toxic metabolites that cause the liver to be insulin resistant. So exercise is absolutely essential, but it's not essential for weight. Diet is about pounds. Exercise is about inches. Diet is about weight. Exercise is about health. And the way to mitigate the negative health effects of fructose is through exercise. So I'm totally for exercise. We advocate it in big ways in our clinic, but you have to know what it's for. Because if you tell somebody, well, if you only exercised, you'd lose weight, and then they go ahead and exercise and they don't lose weight, what do you think is going to happen?
They're gonna feel bad about it and give up.
And get depressed and only eat more.
Right.
Because they figure, to hell with it, there's no hope. So, you know, get it right. And, you know, and I keep telling physicians, you know what you're prescribing and why you're prescribing it. So we prescribe exercise, but I am under no illusion that that's going to actually fix somebody's weight.
Now, one of the things I found fascinating was the comparison of what ethanol does to your body with what fructose does to your body. And it was just, I couldn't believe I didn't know that.
Well, not everybody, you know, can sort of, I mean, you need a little biochemistry to understand this. But let's make it a little bit easier for your listeners. Where do you get ethanol from? Fermentation of fructose. It's called wine.
Right.
Okay,
right.
You ferment the grapes. So the big difference between ethanol and fructose is that for ethanol, the yeast do the first step of metabolism called glycolysis. In fructose, you do it for yourself. But after that first step is over, the second step of metabolism called the tricarboxylic acid or the Krebs cycle is basically exactly the same. And fructose enters the same place ethanol enters. And so if you overload with ethanol, you get metabolic disease. If you overload with fructose, you get metabolic disease. And non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which is now rampant, 45% of Latinos, 33% of Caucasians, 24% of African Americans in this country, and that's not just obese people, that's all people, looks exactly like alcoholic fatty liver disease. The difference is you consume sugar instead of alcohol, but your liver doesn't know the difference.
Mm. Well, what? Let's walk through, I'm sitting here listening to this, let's walk through all the different steps of what I can do, all the way from me being taking care of myself and my family mm-hmm. to wanting to take care of my community and change this.
Right.
So how do I know, if I'm an adult or a child, how do I know if I have a sugar addiction?
Well, sugar addiction is, you know, a strong term. Let's talk about, first of all, what constitutes an addiction
okay.
so that people can actually understand it. The American Psychological Association says that you have to satisfy four criteria to be an addictive substance. And here are the four. Number one, binging. Number two, withdrawal. Number three, craving. And number four, cross-sensitization with other drugs of abuse. Now, that's complicated. Let me take that apart for you. That means that when you look at physiologic responses to one drug and then you introduce a second drug, a different drug, you get the same accentuated physiologic responses. Now, in animal models, sugar, fructose, does all four of those. And I'll prove to you that it can do it in humans. All you have to do is load Morgan Spurlock's famous documentary, Supersize Me, into your DVD player and go to the middle of the movie to day 18 of his ordeal. Everybody knows what this is about. This guy ate nothing but McDonald's for a month.
This one is when the doctor tried to persuade him to stop because he could destroy his liver?
Right. Well, the interesting thing is that the doctor kept saying, you've got to stop this high-fat diet, high-fat diet, high-fat diet. No, 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 no.
Sugar.
High sugar diet.
Yeah.
That was what it was. It was a high sugar diet. But, of
yeah,
course.
Yeah, we've all been told fat's
no.
bad. And you point out part of the problem is we're replacing fats with sugar.
Exactly. Well, here's the problem. What does your liver do with sugar if it can't metabolize it? It turns it to fat. So when you consume glucose, which was, you know, bread, rice, pasta, potatoes, you know, standard white starch, only 2% of what you consumed ends up as fat. When you consume fructose, that is, a glass of orange juice as an example, 30% of what you consumed ends up as fat. So when you consume fructose, you are not consuming a carbohydrate. You are consuming a fat because that's what your body does with it. So this goes directly to one of the major myths in all of nutrition. The famous saying, you are what you eat. Garbage. You are what you do with what you eat. And what you do with sugar is turn it into fat. So in America, a low-fat diet is really a high-fat diet because when they took the fat out, they had to add the sugar in for palatability because low-fat tastes like cardboard. I'll give you an example. Snackwells. Everybody remember Snackwells? Introduced
mm-hmm.
in 1983 after the AHA, AMA, and USDA admonition to reduce our total fat consumption for cardiovascular disease. Well, what was Snackwell's? 2 grams of fat out, 13 grams of carbohydrate in, 4 of which was sugar. You got to do something to make it palatable. And of course, the food industry knew that. So they went kicking and screaming into reformulating all of their foodstuffs. But then what they found was that when they added the sugar, not only did we consume it, but we actually bought more. So what they did was they added some more sugar, and we bought more yet. And they have been continuing to increase and increase and increase the amount of sugar that's in every single one of our foods and generating this obesity epidemic. And the problem is that if you're addicted, that is binging, withdrawal, craving, and cross-sensitization with other drugs, as Morgan Spurlock showed on day 18, he had withdrawal when he didn't eat McDonald's. Basically, you can't stop. So if I told you your breakfast cereal was laced with morphine and told you, don't eat the stuff, do you think you could?
Right.
That's what we've got.
So what do I do if I'm evidencing that pattern or my kids are evidencing that pattern? What do I do?
Well, here's the problem. There is no medicine for this. There's no medicine for caloric excess that ultimately damages your liver. There's no way to take a medicine to stop this. The only way to deal with this is to restrict the amount of substrate, the amount of sugar itself. Now, how do you do that? How do you do that with our current food supply? Well, if you're eating processed food, it's virtually impossible. So the way to do it is to, instead of shopping in your supermarket through the aisles where the shelves are, because every one of those foods is processed, that's why it's on the shelf, because it's got shelf life, which means that they either added fructose or subtracted fiber or both, because that's what processed food equals. Okay, fast food is fiberless food, okay, and fructose rich. What you need to do is walk along the outside of the supermarket. People have said this before. I'm not the first to say this, okay? Because that's where real food is, you know, and the produce section and the meat section and the dairy section, and, you know, shop there. The problem is that if you do that, that means you have to cook, and we don't know how to cook anymore. Okay, and seriously, we do not know how to cook.
Some of us are so exhausted from the sugar addiction that we don't have the energy to cook.
Well, there's some truth to that, too. Bottom line is, we are in a vicious cycle of consumption and disease, and we've got to get out of it. And
right.
The only way to get out of it is to reduce our sugar consumption. Now, it's easy to say. It's hard to do. So we train our patients and our parents in our clinic to actually look at what's going on. A simple rule of thumb. If one of the first three ingredients is sugar, it's a dessert. That's how you should look at it. If any one of the first three ingredients, the problem is there are 40 names for sugar. And there's a reason why there are 40 names for sugar, because the National Labeling Education Act of 1990, which gave us our current Nutrition Facts food label, very specifically says that the ingredients in the label go by mass. In other words, wherever, you know, however much there is, that's what has to come first, second, third. So if you have 5 different sugars, and they take up numbers 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 on the ingredient label.
You can move them to the back.
Why don't you just move them to the front? Because when you add it all up, it's really number 1. That's the point. In addition,
but they're trying to change the name of high fructose corn syrup to something else, aren't they?
To corn sugar. And part of that, of course, is, you know, to try to make it very clear that there's nothing different about high fructose corn syrup versus table sugar or sucrose. And to be honest with you, they're right. There is nothing different. They're both equally bad. They're both dangerous.
Uh-huh.
Now, people, high fructose corn syrup's gotten a terrible name, and I am not here to promote high fructose corn syrup, not in the slightest. But people think that high fructose corn syrup is particularly bad because it's made in a lab. From a metabolic standpoint, it's irrelevant. They're both a problem. So here we have throwback Pepsi. Here, you know, people are taking the high fructose corn syrup out of foods and substituting natural sugar. All that does is drive the price up. But if it doesn't change consumption, then it really doesn't matter. We're not going to see the end of this. What we need to do is de-sweeten our lives. Now, how do we do that? I'll be honest with you. I don't think people can. I don't think it's possible. because of the addictive properties of sugar and because it's in every single foodstuff, I don't think that the current game plan, I don't think the current landscape allows for this. And that's one of the reasons why we keep seeing things going through the roof, why we have now have 32 million sick people on the rolls because of Obamacare, and we're not going to be able to reduce health care expenditures because these people are going to get chronic metabolic disease, and we're going to have to pay for it.
I will say I was stunned when the advice I was given by the subscriber I described, one of the key things was stop drinking any juice, you know, juice or soda or anything with sugar in it,
right.
No sugar liquids, and eat whole fruits instead. And I've been under the impression I shouldn't be eating whole fruits. Well, just those few changes, the cravings and the binging just almost completely went away just from that.
Yep.
Now I eat a ton of fresh food, so.
Well, a lot of people have told me that when they go off sugar, and it takes, the addiction medicine people know this very well. You know, they deal with morphine addiction, heroin addiction, cocaine addiction. You know, it takes about 3 weeks to go cold turkey off an addictive substance before you can sort of start getting out from under. Well, the people who have gone sugar-free say that it takes about 3 weeks to do that. And then after that, the cravings aren't there. The problem is getting through those 3 weeks. And we don't have sugar rehab. You know, it's not like we can lock you up at the Betty Ford Clinic because you're a sugarholic. At least not yet. And certainly insurance isn't going to pay for it.
Right.
You know, they might do it for, alcohol addiction, or they might do it for cocaine or heroin addiction, but they are not going to do it for sugar addiction. So we have some work to do. We have some people we have to, convince. We have a government that basically stands in the way of getting something done here, because after all, what's the USDA's job? To sell food and to protect the food supply, especially from people like me. We've got a poison in it.
If you say the profit margins went to 1% to 5%, then as an investor, I say, that was leveraged in the stock market by multiples of 10 and 20 and derivatives and other things.
Absolutely.
And so the impact of the financial markets of going back to the 1% mm-hmm. is extraordinary. Another point I thought you brought out was if we leave the fiber in food, it makes it much more difficult, if not impossible, to ship it long distances, including export. We're a huge exporter of food.
Exactly. It's about shelf life. It's about depreciation, because shelf life equals depreciation. I mean, if fruit sits on the shelf and depreciates, nobody makes any money. On the other hand, if you squeeze it and freeze it, you can sell it for cheaper, it lasts forever, and everyone makes money. I mean, it's very clear that this is an economic issue, not a medical one. From my standpoint as a physician, this is a public health problem. On the other hand, government's looking at this as an economic problem. I'll give you another thing. I have plotted the stock prices of the various food companies since the economic downturn of 2008. And to a fault, every single one of them has continued to outpace the S&P 500.
Oh, sure.
By very significant amounts. I mean, bottom line, if you want to make some money in this down market, buy food stocks because they're going up. And you know what? It's because of the stress and the downturn in terms of people's pocketbooks, that's actually driving continued food consumption, especially sugar, because that's the reward. When you can't get the reward any other way, this is the reward.
How do I protect my kids from their friends and families who don't understand these things, so they're eating over at their house, or they're going to school and there are a ton of vending machines? I know that California was trying to get them out, but kids are basically constantly exposed and having processed food shoveled at them. How do you keep your kids from just consuming huge amounts of this stuff?
It's a disaster. I don't have good answers of what you do when your kids are out of your house. I mean, the bottom line is train them early. The earlier you can get kids onto a rational food schedule, the better off you are. But if you try to do this in a teenager, I mean, they have their own money. They're going to go to the convenience store as soon as they get out of school. You know, I mean, we specifically keep ethanol 1,000 feet away from any school. We have zoning ordinances to protect our kids from ethanol because we recognize that it is a toxin. It's an acute toxin. You wrap your Lamborghini around a tree, and it's a chronic toxin. You fry your liver. Okay, and there's externalities of ethanol consumption, right? People die in car accidents because of alcoholics. But we're not there with sugar. The externalities are, well, I have to sit next to this 300-pound person on the airplane, and my ticket costs more because, you know, the extra jet fuel from carrying, you know, extra weight around. And finally, my healthcare premiums are higher. That's the externalities that we have from obesity. We don't quite have the same thing as we do with ethanol. So until we get to the point where society says, you know what, enough's enough. We've wasted enough money on this metabolic syndrome, obesity, diabetes epidemic, and it's hurting all of us. And we as a society are going to take a stand and do something about it, and to hell with the food companies. When that day comes, then we'll be in a place where we can do something about it.
And how do we do that? If I said, okay, I'm ready to commit time and resources to really bring about real change, mm-hmm. what do I do?
Well, that's a really good question. And I've, you know, been debating that with my colleagues at the Institute for Health Policy Studies here at UCSF. And the bottom line is it's going to require some societal intervention. But you know what? Some societal interventions come from the bottom up. I'll give you an example, seatbelts. Now, where did seatbelts start? It started in Australia in the 40s and 50s. Now, did the country of Australia know that seatbelts would save lives? No, they didn't. But they have really good public health down there. And they said, you know, this just seems like a good thing to do. And they did it. And they showed that seatbelts saved lives. Well, the big three, which of course is now the big two, went kicking and screaming, and we couldn't get seatbelts into cars in this country until 1979 because the big three blocked it tooth and nail every step of the way until 1979 when finally there was a federal mandate that all new cars had to have seatbelts. Did it save lives?
Yes.
Not at all.
No.
Not even a little bit. Nope. Not even one life did it save during the whole 80s. And the reason was because there was no mandate to wear them.
Oh,
so where did the mandate to wear seatbelts come from? It came from Mothers Against Drunk Driving, MAD. And they petitioned every state house in the country to basically give you a ticket if you didn't wear a seatbelt. And so do seatbelts save lives today?
Yes,
absolutely.
They do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay? As they always should have. But the point is, you can generate the legislation, but it's got to be done right in order for people to benefit, especially at a public health level. And so we have to do that. Now, there is no federal mandate to wear seatbelts today, but there are 50 state mandates to do it. This is going to be a bottom-up, grassroots effort that's going to come from your listeners and from people like me and from, you know, other people in the public health arena that are going to ultimately impact on our politics. And that's what's going to change this, because do not expect the federal government to get behind this, because this is about selling food abroad. And, you know, if we all of a sudden came out and said, you know what, all that sugar we've been putting in all our food all these years, you know, it really isn't so good for you. What do you think that would do to food sales abroad?
Right.
What happened when that one downer cow crossed over, you know, from Canada into Washington State? That was the end of meat sales to Britain and South Korea for 2 years.
Right.
All right? So the USDA's job is to protect this food supply, and that includes protecting it from me. Bottom line, we have to do what we know is right from
right.
a public health standpoint, because it's the right thing to do, because it's the moral thing to do, because people are dying.
I also think there's a great deal we can do to bring down the cost and increase the accessibility of fresh food locally and help people learn how to cook in a way that's fun.
Listen, we put into place a corn subsidy many years ago. And we did that for all sorts of reasons, which, you know, we don't have time to go into. But the bottom line is there's no reason why we can't have a subsidy for healthy foods.
Right. Exactly.
There's no reason. So, you know, this is something that could happen.
One of our listeners had a question. I wanted to know what you thought of stevia, the natural sweetener.
Well, all right. So stevia is a complicated subject, and we probably don't have time, you know, a lot of time for it. Here's what we know so far. And I actually went to a meeting about stevia not too long ago, so I'm pretty up to date on it. So stevia is a natural sweetener, non-caloric, and the pharmacokinetics, that is, what your body does to stevia, seems to be relatively safe. And there's good data on the fact that your body seems to manage stevia in a rational, reasonable fashion without any significant toxicity, as opposed to some of the other artificial sweeteners. What we don't know yet is not the pharmacokinetics, that we know. What we don't know is the pharmacodynamics, that is, what stevia does to you. That hasn't been done yet, and we actually talked with Cargill about this, and they are planning studies to actually look at this question. So I think the jury's still out on stevia, but at least from the standpoint of, is it safe, it does appear that it does not cause any disease process that we know how to look for. So at that level, I can say, you know, stevia is probably the more promising of the artificial sweeteners out there. But can I tell you that it's really good for you and that this would actually make a difference in terms of total caloric consumption? No, I can't do that.
Another question. What is the impact of dietary excess fructose on cancer metabolism?
So there was a study that just came out maybe a month ago out of UCLA saying that if you take pancreatic cancer cells and grow them in a dish and you throw fructose on them, they grow faster than glucose. Now, that's the first salvo in this question of does fructose make cancers grow? I don't know the answer to that. This is an in vitro study. I can't tell you what it means for pancreatic cancer in general. You know, those studies have yet to be performed. What I can say is that chronic metabolic disease, which is exacerbated by both obesity and excess sugar consumption, definitely, without question, increase cancer rates. That I do know. And that's well documented. So there are lots of reasons for cutting back on sugar. Whether or not fructose actually drives cancer, that I can't say yet.
Well, before you go, you have to tell us about your clinic and how we can, you know, how do we connect to you? How do we support you? We have a lot of listeners in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Well, I thank you for asking. Our clinic is called the Weight Assessment for Teen and Child Health Clinic, the WATCH Clinic. Pretty much every obesity clinic around the country has a euphemistic, you know, acronym. You know, because you don't want people to know it's an obesity clinic, or they might not come. We are an interdisciplinary clinic, not a multidisciplinary clinic. There's a difference. Multidisciplinary means you have a lot of different specialties. We do have that, but we have an interdisciplinary clinic because every single specialty has signed on to a set of precepts that we can all live with. And I can sum our precepts up in one sentence. Get the insulin down.
Great.
Any way you can. Okay, insulin's the bad guy. Uh-huh. Insulin's good if you're type 1 diabetic, and it's bad if you're type 2 diabetic. It's that simple. Okay, you want to be insulin sensitive. Okay, you don't want to take extra insulin. You know, extra insulin will lower your blood sugar, but it also has its own negative effects on your vascular system and probably, you know, precipitates coronary disease. So you want to be insulin sensitive. So we want our patients to get their insulin down. And we do that any way we can. We do it through diet. We do it through exercise. We do it through medication when necessary. Bottom line, if we get the insulin down, these patients do better. So we have myself, an endocrinologist. We have gastroenterologists. We have general pediatricians. We have exercise physiologists. We have psychologists. The bad news is that because obesity reimbursement is so lousy, we rely on donations to keep our clinic open. And we are the only clinic in San Francisco. There's one at Children's Oakland, there's one at Stanford, and we are the only one in San Francisco because no one can afford to run one. because reimbursements are so lousy. So we do rely on public support, and if you're interested, my email address is rlustig@peds.ucsf.edu, and I'd love to hear from you.
Okay, and if we go to the website for UCSF, we can find you there?
Absolutely, yes. You go to ucsfmedicalcenter.org or ucsfbenioffchildrenshospital.org and look up obesity, and you will find us. And we think we do a pretty darn good job.
Well, and we hope you're going to make more videos.
Well, I don't know if I'm making any more videos, but I'm certainly writing papers. So the medical establishment gets what's going on. Now we've got.
Can we find your papers on your website?
Yes, you can actually.
Okay, good.
Now we've got to get the general public to buy into the idea that this is public health, not personal responsibility. This is biochemical, not behavioral. No child chooses to be obese.
Right. Okay, well, Dr. Lustig, thank you so much. We can't tell you how much we appreciate everything you're doing. And
thank you for having me.
I look forward to seeing more great things from you.
We hope so.
Have a great night.
Thank you so much. You too.
Okay, next week, live from Switzerland, I'll be in Europe on business and reporting on the European perspective. And then the first week in October, the third quarter wrap-up. We do a wrap-up each quarter. In the meantime, Soleri, Silver, and Gold, please call us. We want to help you get educated. I've been driving. This week I drove from Texas to Arizona, and David Lichty has been, as he gets questions and people want advice, I've been on the cell phone having the most amazing conversations with customers from all around the country, helping to get you educated. We really want to make sure you understand gold and silver and what you want to do, why you want to do it. We want educated customers, so please feel free to call. We're there to help you. So until next week when I speak to you from the mountains of Switzerland, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.